All right, guys, we're going to get started again with our next session, which is the A to Z's of consular processing. And again, we have two wonderful speakers with us today who I will introduce. Mel Fabian, who's a senior associate at the office of Barry Appleman and Leiden. She's passionate about helping her clients navigate the U.S. immigration laws and finding creative solutions that allow families and professionals to stay in the U.S. She is also a Chinese-Canadian immigrant and understands firsthand many of the issues and challenges that her clients face. Our second speaker is Rosemary Vega, who's the owner of the law office of Rosemary Vega. Prior to that, she was the clinical lecturer at the University of Houston Immigration Law Clinic. She also owned her own practice. And was a partner at Tosk and Vega, where she practiced immigration law, and was prior to that also the sole staff attorney at the YMCA International Services in Houston. So please help me to welcome our speakers.
Good morning, everybody. So our topic this morning is on the A to Z's of consular processing and all of the glorious details in between. So I thought that it might be a good idea for us to kick off the discussion with some of the strategy considerations as to when a case should be filed consular processing as opposed to filing in the country. So I will start with, you know, some of the NIV or business immigration perspective on that. So the most common scenario for someone to be filing the case consular processing would be obviously if they're outside of the United States, right? So they don't have any other status otherwise in the States, or say that they've maxed out on their immigration status previously, and so they have to wait out that process abroad before they can kind of apply for a visa to re-enter the U.S. Another kind of common situation is if somebody is traveling and their travel dates kind of coincide with that filing. So instead of kind of waiting for that process to be completed in the country, they can be, you know, waiting for that process to be completed when they travel to their home country, et cetera. Another situation that came up for me recently was a case where somebody was already in an H-4 status, and they were also selected in the H-1B lottery. So their employer really wanted that person to be in H-1B status. But he wanted to remain in H-4, and he has an H-4 EAD. So we filed the H-1B consular because that gives him that control over when he wants to switch his status to H-1B, right? So that gives him that kind of ownership and control over that process. In case something happens to, you know, his spouse, H-1B, he can at least have a backup or default and get that visa to change his status. Another situation for me where I, you know, typically would recommend consular processing is, say, for Canadians, and we'll kind of talk about Canadian in a later slide. I would typically recommend that they kind of go through the port of entry whenever possible. You know, part of that consideration there, particularly for Canadians, number one, it's typically cheaper, but also they get 3 years, say, for an L, versus they only get 2 years at a port of with USCIS filing. So, Rosemary, do you see kind of any other, you know, strategy considerations from an IV perspective?
So for IV, it's different, right? Because with the IV, they don't have a lot of give, right? You're either, when you're doing immigrant visas, your client, if they can adjust in the United States, they want to adjust in the United States, right? That's like the golden rule. But if they can adjust in the United States and they have to consular process, unfortunately, they're going to have to consular process. So when are they going to have to consular process? So your client is unfortunately entered the United States without a visa and is not married to a U.S. citizen, right? Not married to a U.S. citizen, married to a legal permanent resident.